This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the United States has to answer to the United Nations for its treatment of political prisoners. And Dr. Cornel West tackles the question, is there a contradiction between religion and revolution? But first, the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations held a rally and march on the White House. Larry Hamm, chairman of POP, the New Jersey-based People's Organization for Progress, spoke for the entire coalition of Black organizations when he called for massive demonstrations in the streets of every U.S. city on the day after. By that, he meant the day after a grand jury decides whether or not to indict the police officer that killed Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri.
Black is back. Black is back. Peace through revolution. Peace through revolution. Revolution, the only solution. Revolution, the only solution. Revolution, the only solution. Power to the people. I'm glad to be here to join with you today in this demonstration as we demand justice at home and abroad. And I just want to begin with the same theme that the previous speaker was dealing with, and that is the issue of police brutality in our community. And the theme that dovetails with that, which was addressed by the speaker before her, and that is the militarization that is going on in our communities. But brothers and sisters, the militarization of the Black community did not begin in Ferguson. It didn't begin in 2014. Militarization began when the first slaves were taken from Africa. That's when militarization began. Because you cannot enslave a people without the exercise, the use of the most brutal, heinous, and horrific force that can be imagined. And this begins with the slave trade, and it continues through the enslavement of Africans in the Western Hemisphere. The state police, as we know them today, state militia, as we know them today, grew out of the slave patrols of those colonies that had enslaved Africans and enslaved indigenous people. Because remember, their enslavement began before ours. In fact, last month was Columbus Day. People run around here celebrating Columbus. That should have been a national day of mourning for Black and brown people all throughout the United States of America. A national day of mourning. Because it is with the advent of Columbus in the Caribbean that we see the beginning of the slave trade in the Western Hemisphere. The first slaves he took were the indigenous, the Arawak, the Carib, the Boricua. And then when that didn't work out, they went and got the African. And we see with the rise and development of the slave trade, the use of the most brutal force imaginable, both publicly condoned and sanctioned by law and privately on the property of those slave masters. Slaves were whipped and flogged and beaten and flayed. You know what flailing is? That's when they tear your skin off of your body. That's flailing. And I was reminded of this with the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. What happened after they shot Michael Brown? They let his body lay in the street, not for a half hour or an hour or a delay because traffic was bad and the ambulance get through. They let Michael Brown's body lay on the streets of Ferguson for four damn hours. Why? Why leave his body out there? Was it just some oversight? Some bureaucratic snafu? No. This was the technique of terror. It was meant to set a terroristic message to the black community that this is what is in store for you. But fortunately, the black youth of Ferguson were not scared. And they stood up and they raised up their voices and they raised themselves up in opposition to what is going on in Ferguson. But this is what they used to do during slave rebellions. They would behead African slaves and put their heads on pike. Read the story of Nat Turner, whose birthday just passed in October. They would draw and quarter slaves. Do you know what drawn quartering is? That's when they tie a horse on every limb of your body and whip those horses until they tear your body apart. The very Constitution of this country sanctioned, condoned, supported the enslavement of African people and the indigenous people in this country. And so institutions of force had to grow up and develop to hold people, because people are not going to be peacefully enslaved. The history of black people in this country, contrary to what we have been taught, is not a history of the acceptance of oppression. It is a history of resistance and rebellion every day that we have been here in the Western Hemisphere, brothers and sisters. There were hundreds of slave rebellions, and the slave rebellions didn't end with the Civil War. Every time black people rise up against police brutality like they rose up in Ferguson, that is a slave rebellion. That is an rebellion of the racially oppressed in this country. And I tell you today that Ferguson might be the first in a while, but it's not going to be the last, brothers and sisters. They keep killing our people like this. We're going to keep fighting back. And if they don't play by the rules, then we don't have to play by nobody's rules. In fact, all rules will be off if they continue to kill our people, shoot them down like dogs every day of the year with impunity and receive no punishment. Amadou Diallo shot 19 times. No punishment, not even a ticket. Trayvon Martin, no penalty. No penalty. We could call names all day long. They kill us with impunity. But it's time for us to build a national response to this. You know, it's like a passion play. How many Catholics we got in here? You know the passion play, the story of Jesus, right? You know the story, right? You know what the outcome is going to be, right? You know what the stations of the cross are, right? You know where Jesus stopped and everything. What's going on right now in Ferguson is a passion play. We know what the outcome is going to be. The grand jury is not going to indict Darren Wilson for the murder of Michael Brown. They're not going to do it. They've already sent signals to you that they're not going to do it. The mayor, 4 or 5 months after Michael's death, issued an apology. What is that? That's an attempt to placate people. That's what they call it, Brother O'Malley, soft counterinsurgency. Because you know the same techniques, the same counterinsurgency techniques that they use over there, they use it over here. The same counterinsurgency techniques they use in Palestine, they use it on black communities right there. Soft insurgency, they bring out the community leaders, they bring out the politicians, and they tell everybody, be calm. It's all right. We got this. Look, we're going to implement some reforms. We're going to hire more black police officers. We're going to have more black supervisors. We're going to have residency requirements. We're going to have sensitivity training. We're going to create a civilian review board. We're going to have body cameras. But all of that ain't justice. Justice is the arrest and imprisonment and conviction of Darryl Wilson, who killed Michael Brown. That's justice, brothers and sisters. Anything short of that is not justice. Anything short of that is not justice. Anything short of that are reforms to placate and diminish your righteous indignation and your righteous anger. But this is what I have to say about what's going on in Ferguson and about what's happening with the grand jury. I say that the day after, if the grand jury decision comes on a Monday, then on a Tuesday. If it comes on a Thursday, then on a Friday. If it comes on Friday, then on Saturday. Whatever the day is that they come back without an indictment, we should fill the streets of America the very next day, brothers and sisters. Fill the streets of America. Fill the streets of America. I call on today every organization, every grassroots organization, every political party, every labor union, every church, every mosque, every fraternal organization, every sorority, every fraternity, any kind of, every block club, any chess club, I don't care what your club is, you take your members into the streets the day after that grand jury verdict comes back, brothers and sisters. And it shouldn't be one day of protest. We should keep the protest, we should keep the fire lit for as long as we can. Because I don't know about you, I can't take it anymore. I can't watch my black mother's tears anymore. I can't see the grief of my people anymore. I can't stand to see one more mother without her son, one more sister without her brother, one more grandfather without his son. I can't take it no more. It's time for us to strike back. They hit us, we hit back, brothers and sisters. We got to hit back. It can't be any of that accepting our oppression anymore or trying to say it's something other than what it is. I don't know about you, but I don't see any improvement in the condition of the masses of people here in the United States. What I see is the further immiseration of the people. I don't see any American dream, as Malcolm said. I see an American nightmare. I see families that have lost their homes to foreclosure. I see millions of people. You can't go to any one of these fast food restaurants and sit there for more than 10 minutes without somebody coming up to you and ask. They ain't even asking for money no more. They're asking for food. The people are begging in the streets, and yet the corporate class is taking home more profits than have ever been made in the history of mankind. I say it's time for a change. I say we take their corporate profits and put it in the hands of the people who are losing their homes. Put it in the hands of the students that are thousands of dollars in debt. Put it in the hands of the homeless that don't have a place to live. Put it in the hands of the PTA for all the schools that they're closing here in Washington, D.C. Put it in the hands of the families who've lost their sons and their daughters to police brutality. We need a change, brothers and sisters. We just don't need reform. We need revolution. That's what we need in America. We need revolution. And we need to get organized and build up our organizations. And don't be afraid to say we need revolution. You ain't saying nothing else that Dr. King didn't say. You going on what the corporate class told you about Dr. King. Now read what Dr. King himself said. He said we need a radical transformation of our socioeconomic system. Those are his words. He said we need a radical redistribution of power and wealth in this country. But that's not going to come about through wishing and hoping and singing and praying. That's going to come about through organizing our people and helping them to understand that we must change this situation, not just for ourselves, brothers and sisters, but for future generations. So if you don't remember anything else that I said today, remember this: the day after, the day after, the day after, the day after, the day after. Fill the streets. Fill the streets. Fill the streets. Thank you. Power to the people.
The entire Black is Back coalition endorsed Larry Hamm's proposal for massive demonstrations the day after a grand jury decision on Michael Brown. The day after the Black is Back march on the White House, the coalition held a teach-in at Howard University. Black is Back chairman Omali Yeshitela said the days of white supremacy are numbered. Yours truly, Glenn Ford, also spoke at the teach-in on why U.S. imperialism is at war with the world. First, Omali Yeshitela.
The capitalist world economy came about as a consequence of slavery and colonialism. And when it came about, it didn't disappear. The capitalist world economy is a thing that gave rise to what people now refer to as white power. White power and capitalism emerged as a world system. It didn't just happen in Manchester, in England, or something like that. And what you have is the economic base of the whole world economy has been organized around slavery and colonialism. That Europe, white people achieved their identity that we call national identity as a consequence of slavery and colonialism. That is what gave birth to the white man and Europe itself. There was no such thing as Europe up until the 17th century. And before then, you just had this mass of tribes constantly at war with each other who defined themselves primarily in relationship to each other. The thing that consolidated their identity as one, primarily as one, it's not totally like that, is slavery. Because they all engaged in slavery and benefited from slavery that helped to create the world economy and colonialism. Slavery and colonialism gave rise to Europe, the white man, if you will, and to the capitalist social system. And it represents itself in a thousand different ways institutionally. Because when you have the economic base, and informing the economic base is what people refer to as a superstructure. The superstructure consists of the ideas, the ideology, the institutions, political and other kinds of institutions, even churches and culture are influenced by that. People talk about racism. The ideas and institutions that come out of this can only be anti-black, anti-anything other than white, because it reinforces the economic base. What is happening in the world is this whole economic foundation is being challenged in a very serious way. When people in Afghanistan try to take back their own oil, poor people who don't even have enough bread to feed their own children, who fought successfully for more than 13 years against U.S. imperialism, when they try to take back their own resources, when African people in other places try to make Africa ours as opposed to theirs, that means it is a threat on a parasitic relationship that Europe has imposed on us and the rest of the world. Yes. That creates economic instability that reflects itself all kinds of different ways depending on where you are located in this thing. And it also challenges the psychology and the ideological foundation of this country as well, and you see that manifesting itself at various times. There is indeed a shift in the balance of forces in the world, where you now have a world, 80% of the people on Earth trying to survive off $10 US or less a day, 50% of the people on earth trying to survive off $2.50 or less a day. And if you're in Africa trying to survive off a dollar or less a day, that's the reality that we live with today. That's the historical contradiction that we are contending with that has to be changed. Yes. People trying to take their oil back, who now become terrorists because they want their stuff back. People want their resources back. Yeah. People want their children to be able to grow up and have a future. Yeah. And they don't give a damn whether or not somebody is going to lose their student loan or their 401k privileges in the United States and Europe. They want their stuff back. I want ours back. Yeah. And this is the thing that's challenging this whole balance of forces in the world. And that's all the stuff that we see happening that Glenn's going to tell you about.
The first fact that we have to discuss is why the United States is in a state of war with virtually the entire world. And that is a fact. This is the reason that the United States, through its NSA, spies not just against those countries that have been designated as enemies of the United States, but against the entire populations, everybody who has a telephone or access to the internet in every other country in the world, in Spain and France and Italy, everywhere. It has designated all of the world as a potential enemy. And why is this? When I was born in 1949, the United States made 60%, 3 out of 5 of the finished products, the machines, anything that had to be manufactured. 60% of the machinery of the world was made in the United States. Now, the United States accounts for 20-something% of the finished goods, and the bulk of production has been shifted to China. China either will be very, very soon the largest economy in the world, or it already is the largest economy in the world, depending upon how you want to measure it. And so the United States, which shrinks proportionally in terms of its economic presence in the world, and only maintains a domination in the world through the dollar, and most importantly, through its military power, its power to coerce other countries, that is, to distort the world's economy through force of arms in its own favor, an artificial dominance. Because the United States objectively becomes weaker and weaker, it puts itself in a position now where it must, in defense, as far as it is concerned, actually weaken the economies of the world. Now, that is something that's never talked about in corporate media, that the sum total effect and the intention of the United States, its overall strategy, is geared towards weakening the most productive forces in the world. And so it provokes Russia with its support of Nazis, straight up Nazis, with swastikas, all the whole Halloween paraphernalia, supports them in Ukraine, trying to provoke Russia. Yes. It wages this proxy war in Syria for lots of reasons, but strategically, the most important reason, it wants to divert the pipeline delivery systems of oil in the region away from Syria, Iraq, and Iran, because those countries are thought by the United States to be, because of their Shia religion and the history of revolutionary politics in those three countries, not dependable places, places that they can control. They want the pipelines that go to China from the oil-producing areas to be in countries that are puppets of the United States. Why? So that they can threaten at some juncture when the United States wants to play its military card, to also play the oil card and cut off supplies to China. And the Ukrainian provocation was designed to cut off trade between Russia and Western Europe, because Russia is a cornucopia of resources and could be producing three or four times as much as it does now and satisfying the needs of Europe and thereby politically changing the posture of Europe and further isolating the United States. So all of this is to depress these rising forces in the world. And that's why the United States is objectively at war with the rest of the world. It has a real problem, though. Much of the world knows that it's being waged war upon. Certainly all of the Arab world knows that. And all the polls show that if anybody, any group of people, hate the United States, it is the people of the Middle East. And the U.S. certainly deserves that hatred. But the U.S., because it is so hated, and because its wars also cause domestic problems for it, cannot deploy its own troops in that region. It found that out under Bush, and it caused great embarrassment, a huge setback for U.S. Prestige and actual power in the world when the Iraq adventure went awry. So the U.S. needs surrogates to enforce its will in that part of the world. And since the early stages of Afghanistan, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan have used the most right-wing reactionary elements of Islam, the jihadist forces, as their proxies, originally to subvert secular governments, like the left-wing government that was in power in Afghanistan, and then against the mainly secular government of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. And that was successful with the help of NATO as the jihadist air force. And then they deployed those folks in Syria for the same effect against a secular government. The presumption in using these jihadists is that they would act as mercenaries, as puppets, as pawns, that they would take the U.S. guns and the U.S. and Saudi Arabian and Qatari money and just do their bidding. The United States, being the racist, fundamentally racist nation it is, does not believe that other people have ideologies and worldviews of their own, and that other people will, when they see the opportunity, try to act upon those ideologies. All that has come to an acute contradiction now in Syria, where you have ISIS, this agglomeration of jihadists who have decided that they're going to put their ideology, which calls for a caliphate, their ideology, which would deny the legitimacy of their sponsors from Qatar and Saudi Arabia and all of these royal kingdoms in Kuwait and Jordan. In other words, all of these royal regimes that underpin U.S. influence on the ground in that region. The very jihadists that were called forth into existence as an international force. There have always been jihadists, but they have never been an international force until they were empowered to be so by the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Pakistan about 30 years ago. Now that Frankenstein has turned, and so there is a crisis in the very region of the world that the United States was militarizing, was throwing into chaos and war in order to strangle China. Now that Frankenstein has become a wild card in that region, and the United States cannot use its vaunted military power on the ground, because once the U.S. is on the ground, everybody who seems to be in league with the U.S. becomes the enemy of every other Arab and Muslim. So the contradictions become more and more acute. But in the end of this process, the U.S. becomes even more isolated and is cut down to a size that is more consistent with its real presence in the world economy. which is in the low 20s, cut down to something that we would recognize as a normal nation. And it's not bad to be a normal nation, but you can't be a normal nation and an imperialist at the same time. So in U.S. imperialism, which presently is the enemy of everybody else in the world, because it must be, or else it's not imperialist anymore, is facing an isolation that probably, because largely of this Ukrainian situation, but I think will result also from the vast question marks that hang over the Middle East, we are going to see a situation in which, because of necessity, countries are going to start getting out of the dollar. Everybody's now talking about so-called market baskets, where you just have a combination of currencies, or even the creation of a new currency that is backed by all kinds of other currencies. And if there is no dollar, if there is no dollar, there is no monetary basis for U.S. imperialism. It is halfway down the tubes. We see chaos and vast crimes around the world inflicted by U.S. imperialism, and the crimes are so gory that sometimes we get depressed and measure the United States by the gravity and weight of its crimes. But that's not the way you should measure the opponent. Just because he is capable of infinite evil does not mean that he's infinitely powerful. And if we look in what the U.S. used to consider its own backyard in Latin America, there's now a new organization that is taking over many of the responsibilities of the old Organization of American States, the OAS. The OAS was formed in 1949. It was formed by the United States as a Cold War instrument to keep communists out of the U.S. backyard in Latin America. So that is the genesis of the OAS. Latin American nations do not take any of their problems to the OAS anymore because they know their problem comes from the United States. So they formed an organization whose Spanish acronym is pronounced as CELAC. That's the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States. Those are 32 countries, 600 million people, and it specifically prohibits, welcomes everybody in the Western Hemisphere except the United States and Canada. And that is the rising tide of history. That if the Latin Americans can do that and just say, you go to hell, you don't need to be in our gatherings because you poison them by your very presence, then the rest of the world is not going to be far behind.
I just really think it's important for us to understand that imperialism is in a state of crisis, but it's not dying, it's being killed. And that we can play a role in taking this sucker out. And I've heard people say, well, the world economy might collapse. Woe is us. Woe, hell? How the hell do you say woe is us? The economy that they keep together with drones and stuff like that, where 80% of the people on Earth trying to live off $10 or less. You can do that if the economy and the police was gone. We can do better than that, you know, right now. So we need to see this thing gone. And I just think that people around the world, and the future belongs to us if we will seize it. And we have a lot of work to do, and I'm particularly concerned about black people, Africans, to recapture the revolutionary movement that we tried to create and not to settle for the Sharptons and for the Jesse Jackers and the Obamas and all these other sellouts who are standing up there saying you can't say anything because after all he's one of them. They are not us. Obama is not the people. Sharpton is not the people. Jackson is not the people. They are not the people. They are against the people. So we have to be willing. We have a responsibility to lead. Not just to be swept up in this situation that's been created by our oppressors. That's our responsibility, to get out and take charge.
Omali Yesha Taylor, chairman of the Black is Back Coalition. The coalition endorsed a call to ask countries sympathetic to the black struggle to demand the release of political prisoners in the United States.
Afia Wangaza of the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination is among the Americans who are now in Geneva, Switzerland for a United Nations review of U.S. government treatment of political prisoners, especially those incarcerated during the era of the civil rights and black liberation movements. Wangaza explains what she and her comrades hope to accomplish.
The object we have is for, again, putting and keeping COINTELPRO civil rights era political prisoners on the global human rights agenda. So we will be calling the United States to account as to actual torture. We know that many of the political prisoners were in fact tortured, and that torture testimony through confessions were proffered again as recently as the San Francisco 8 and still clings to some of the currently imprisoned COINTELPRO civil rights era political activists and human rights defenders. So we will be raising the issue of actual torture, ripping out people's fingernails and busting their spleens and garden variety cattle prodders on genitalia. The cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment is bridged with the torture as represented by the solitary confinement or prolonged cellular isolation, as it's called, where all of our political prisoners have at some point or another suffered extended isolation under international law, more than 15 days, and indefinite isolation is considered torturous. So that is the second aspect of it. And they are still, the political prisoners are still subject to instances of solitary confinement and the continuing impact, especially for years of solitary confinement, is well documented. We know that Albert Woodfox, the last of the imprisoned Angola Three, has been in solitary confinement for, he's in his 42nd year. So we will be pointing to that as an example. There are several instances of medical neglect, which constitutes cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, where all of the political prisoners have been subjected to little or no or inadequate medical care. And we will focus on a number of current medical emergencies. At the top of the list, of course, is Jamil Alamine, who was recently diagnosed with cancer. There are others who, Malmin, who has chronic, severe breathing, respiratory deterioration, as well as others who have varying degrees of illness, that those cases are cited at the UN's website, as well as at the U.S. Human Rights Network's website. We'll be looking at the perfunctory manner in which parole hearings have been held. And although we've had a rash of favorable rulings, the truth of the matter is that these people have been incarcerated for 25, 30 years, in some instances 40, and of course in the case of Rochelle McGee, 51 years, the world's longest held political prisoner. So that there is no genuine access to justice for political prisoners, COINTELPRO civil rights era political prisoners specifically. We'll also make the call that the prisoners have requested of the formation of a truth and reconciliation process. What that is going to wind up looking like remains to be negotiated, but that is in addition to their immediate unconditional release is the second demand. And so we will carry those demands forward to Geneva, basing the righteousness of them and the requirement of the United States to address them, indeed adhere to them, based on its violations of the Convention Against Torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, combined with the success that we've had in the previous treaty reviews, the most notable being, of course, in this past August with the Convention for the elimination of racial discrimination, wherein the United States has been instructed to come back at its regular hearing and to inform the body of the status of COINTELPRO civil rights era political prisoners.
Since we last spoke, as you say, there have been some favorable parole rulings. Could you tell us about them?
It's so exciting that, first of all, I guess it would be Sekou Odinga, who should be coming home shortly, within the coming 30 days. The second would be Suliata Kolli, Asada Shakur's co-defendant, for whom the state of New Jersey was ordered by the New Jersey Court of Appeals to release him. Now, no date was set, and of course, the state of New Jersey will be appealing. So that may be somewhat delayed unless, of course, he is able to get an appeal bond. I'm not on his legal team, so I don't know the intricacies of that aspect of his case or what their plans are, but that was indeed a favorable ruling. I would caution undue optimism in light of the fact that we have the case of Veronica Bowers, who has maxed out of his sentence. He was wrongfully convicted for killing a federal park ranger who allegedly discovered him having killed a deer out of season. So you can see how ridiculous that scenario is. And he was sentenced to 30 years to life, if my memory serves me correctly. At any rate, at the time that he was sentenced, the average was to serve 30 years. He has served well beyond that 30 years. There have been several federal orders reviewing his case and directing that the Bureau of Prisons release him, and also that he has received favorable recommendations from the wardens. He has received favorable recommendations even from the Bureau of Prisons. However, when Bush was in office and Alberto Gonzalez was the Attorney General, the Fraternal Order of Police were able to thwart his successful efforts of being released. So despite the existence of court orders, he is still in federal prison. And we know that Herman Wallace and even Albert Woodfall has received favorable rulings ordering his release, and there he sits to this date. So while we've gotten a favorable response, it has to be tempered with what we know the facts to be. Mutulu Shakur was given the date of April 2015 for release, and that is, of course, being appealed, and he is defending against that appeal. So, again, we've seen significant favorable rulings, and what comes of them and how they materialize remains to be seen. Brother Koti, I don't want to forget about him. A brother who's like 80-some years old, who was supposed to have been released last month, as I understand it, is still in custody. So just before each of these events, these treaty reviews, we found that some radical action or unexpected action occurs, and whether or not they reach full maturation and people are in fact released remains to be seen. But we believe that along with all the other activities and support that is given to political prisoners, that the treaty review process brings an intensifying light onto the treatment of political prisoners and forces the U.S. government and its subsidiaries to take into account the opinion of the world. And we know that there's a history of the United States taking global public opinion into account in its treatment of folk in this country, generally, and Black folk in particular.
Yes, we know that international treaty laws, wheels turn very slowly, but is there anything dramatic that might come out of this session at Geneva?
We're looking for everybody to be brought out of isolation, for one thing. Secondly, as with all of the treaties, there is a requirement of access to justice. And that winds up being our ultimate goal here, the call for the negotiation of a truth and reconciliation process that will resolve the remaining issues of the civil rights era, and that is our political prisoners. We also expect that with favorable results, whether it's simply calling for their release, acknowledging their existence, and challenging U.S. on the conditions under which they're held, will be the basis for further action with the Inter-American Court for Human Rights, which will be the first a case of first impression on behalf of COINTELPRO civil rights era political activists and human rights defenders. So we don't leave in any group, any review or reviewer's hand, or any institution for that matter, the determination as to what the fate of the political prisoners will be, nor of what the course of action will be. These are all approaches that have never been taken before, and as I was saying to someone earlier, awakens the initiative, the petition that was initially filed by Jaleel Montekin back in 1979, I believe it was, from his San Quentin prison cell. So we have revived that concept, given it new life. We've invigorated the political prisoner community both in and out of prison, and we're hoping that it will be sustained and that we will expand beyond, as we would say, the usual suspects and bring in the general community, as has other struggles been able to do. In March, we expect to join with the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday and of the Selma to Montgomery Voting Rights March and political prisoners, and our tradition of resistance will be celebrated. So that will be a major opportunity to not only celebrate political prisoners as a class through the generations, but it will also be an opportunity to educate our community and to validate the tradition that has been written out of the history books. And then, of course, in May of 2015, we go back to Geneva, having made a complete circle, where the United States is again confronted with the initial demand that all political prisoners be released.
In light of recent developments in and surrounding Ferguson, Missouri, people are talking about the emergence of some kind of new or re-energized movement. But how can people be discussing a new movement when so many political prisoners from the last great movement 40-something years ago remain in jail?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it is a point that I have been making for the 40-something years since the SNCC Atlanta Project, of which I was a member, drafted the position papers on which the modern day call for Black power gave the movement the militancy, or advanced the militancy embodied in Malcolm X, and resulted in the more militant and thus political prisoners that we have today. It's problematic. It's extremely problematic because as we wait for the decisions of the grand jury in Missouri, New York, and other places, what then do we do when they come back, as can be predicted, with a no bill, where there is no indictment? Is just rallying at the federal building adequate? Is just, you know, burning down our part of the town enough? Or do we, as the Black Panther Party so heroically and courageously did 40 years ago, patrol our own streets and to challenge the occupation of our communities and the resultant murder that we see every 28 hours? We're at a really critical point, and we've been here before. The question is how we're going to answer it this time. Are we going to answer it in a way that is going to bring dignity to us as a people and assert our human right of self-determination and self-defense?
Afia Wangaza and other activists will be tweeting from the United Nations at Cat Poll Prisoners, CATPOL Prisoners. Black Agenda Report will also be at the UN session in Geneva, Switzerland. Mumia Abu-Jamal is America's best-known political prisoner. He reports regularly for Prison Radio from his place of incarceration at Frackville State Prison in Pennsylvania. This week, Abu-Jamal tells us that the Dallas Six are going to court.
They're called the Dallas Six, and we ain't talking about Texas. Dallas, in Pennsylvania, is one of nearly 30 prisons in the state located in its rural outback. The Six are young black men who, in 2010, tried to stage a peaceful protest in the prison's hole or its solitary confinement unit. They were moved to such protest after they witnessed another prisoner, Isaac Sanchez, being strapped into a torture chair. Prison officials call it a restraint chair. For hours, even overnight. When guards threatened to do the same to them, the men tried to cover their cell doors with their bedding and refused to leave their cells. The guards armed themselves with batons and electrified equipment, and they stormed the Six cells, leaving the men beaten, bloody, naked, their flesh seared with pepper spray. All of the guards later admitted they suffered no injuries. How could they? They wore black body armor and helmets, which the prisoners call Star Wars clothing. After some of the men filed grievances and civil suits, the district attorney replied with criminal charges, and on November 10, 2014, the men will be marched into Luzerne County Courthouse in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, to face riot charges. They were gassed, they were beaten, they were tasered and zapped with electro shields, and they face riot charges. It should be noted that this was the very same county where judges took money to send kids to jail, where no one reported their monstrous actions, not even the DA, for nearly a decade. The Dallas Six, Andre Jacobs, Anthony Kelly, Carrington Keyes, Anthony Locke, Dwayne Peters, and Derek Stanley are potentially facing new prison terms for refusing to submit to torture. For men have died in America while strapped in the torture chair. Stand up for the Dallas Six. Stand up for justice and human rights. For more information on the Dallas Six, go to scidallas6.blogspot.com.
Mumia Abu-Jamal. Revolutionary Communist Party activist Carl Dix has appeared on many public forums with Dr. Cornel West, the public intellectual and activist. Dix and West were co-founders of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. On Saturday, November 15th, Dr. West will have a public conversation with RCP leader Bob Avakian at New York City's historic Riverside Church. Carl Dix thinks it'll be an interesting evening.
I began my series of dialogues with Cornell in the immediate aftermath of the election of Obama, and there was a whole lot that had to be gone at and cut through because many, many people felt that Obama's election meant an end to the oppression of black people, that the wars would end, you know, that milk and honey would flow in the land, just about. And we were dialoguing to take on that misconception and to bring out to people that we were not dealing with individuals, and George Bush was a bad individual, but now we had a good individual in Obama. But we were dealing with a system based on exploitation and oppression. And whether or not the person presiding over that system was a black man or a white person, that the white supremacy, the exploitation and oppression that that system meant for folks here and around the world was still going to be in effect. It was very controversial to do that right at the start. Things have changed somewhat on that. A lot more people have awakened to the fact that, no, it ain't post-racial. It is still white supremacist America. We're still up against the same horrors, and who's in the White House don't transform that. So that's what we went through in our dialogues, and as we went through it, we more focused on the question of mass incarceration and the need to act to stop it. And those dialogues actually led into some of the activity that we did around Stop and Frisk, the campaign to stop Stop and Frisk.
How you get tickets?
First off, website revcom.us, revcom.us. You can find out how to buy tickets online. There are also outlets for tickets in the New York City area. You can find that out by going to revcom.us. One of the outlets is Revolution Books in Manhattan, and you can look that up and go there. The other thing that you'll find on the website, revcom.us, is that transportation is being organized from various parts of the country. I know folks from Atlanta are getting on the bus and coming up. Same for folks from Chicago. There's some folks in Ferguson who are trying to organize collective transportation because they want to get up and check this thing out. So go to the website, revcom.us, and you can find information on tickets, on transportation, more information about the dialogue.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.